are three basic types of lessons that a preacher can preach. One is just imparting information without any real application, and that's what we did the last couple of lessons with translations and inspiration. Other lessons, like the one this morning, are upbeat and designed to make us feel good and make us be motivated and excited about what we're doing. And then there's the kind of lesson tonight, the kind that are beating us up and making us feel bad and making us want to go home and climb under a rock or something, because we all have a lot we still have to work with. This is a tough lesson. This is a tough series that I developed years ago, and I never feel very good while I'm preaching it, because even after all these years, and I think all of us will recognize as we start into the lesson, that this is a real struggle, because we all struggle with selfishness. Selfishness means putting our own needs above the needs of other people. And it's we all have, I guess, what we would call a comfort zone, where we feel comfortable. This is my time, and this is their time. I don't know that Jesus had any, quote, my time. I don't know that Jesus spent very much of his life doing anything but serving other people. He came to this earth with that specific purpose. It doesn't appear, of course, obviously, he didn't have a family. He didn't have a house or a place to lay his head. His occupation was completely involved in training the apostles, guiding them and preaching to the lost, and trying to help the Pharisees and the scribes understand what they needed to do. And so as we begin our lesson, we want to go back to the beginning, where we're all pretty much the same, and that is a helpless newborn. And we've talked about this several times in the past, but basically a newborn is completely selfish. They have no concept whatsoever of any other need but their own. And that's where we all started. We all started with this sense, and parents don't complain. As you see here, they can wake us up. They can be crying for this, crying for that, wanting this need, wanting that need. No point in getting upset. That's what you knew you were getting into when you had a baby, because that's how babies are. They're helpless, and we do everything for them. But the transition occurs in Jesus' life, and I know he was 12 years old here, but I still want to capture the basic idea, and that is he went down with them and came to Nazareth and was subject to them. But his mother kept all these things in her heart, and Jesus increased in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and men. So this is the normal path that we are all to take. Jesus was a baby. Jesus went through that time where he was completely selfish, and he went through the time where the transition occurred, and he increased in wisdom, and he increased in favor with God and men, because the way you get favor is you do things for people, and you help people, and you become somebody who's indispensable. Well, what is an indispensable person? An indispensable person is a person like the person we read about in chapter 9 of Acts, and that is Dorcas. She was full of good works and alms deeds. She was indispensable, and when she was gone, all the widows were crying. Now, were they crying because of her selfishness, because she spent so much time doing her own things, or were they crying because she gave up a lot of her time in order to make herself indispensable? And this is the criteria that we need to look at. Now, some transitions are more smooth than others. We've all read about the strong-willed child. And, of course, the strong-willed child just happens to be a little more selfish than all the rest of them, and a little more headstrong about doing it their way and doing what they want to do. And we have often heard that the strong-willed child is the child that if you can channel into the right direction, they will be the ones with convictions, and they will be the ones that will truly be a tremendous asset. So even though they might start off poorly, they have the potential to do more, but the parent has a lot more work. And this passage, I've come to believe after all these years that this foolishness that's bound up in the heart of the child is the selfishness that we had when we were infants. And then when we go through the, quote, terrible twos, we're making that transition. We don't want to give that up. Now, some children are more pliable than others. Some children are less selfish than others. But all of us have to recognize where we came from. And ask ourselves, how well did my parents do in removing that foolishness? Because that's part of the reason why we're having these problems. Now, our parents did try to help. Most of them did. I don't know whether your parents did or not. You have to make that decision on your own. Doesn't really matter, because it just means we got a little further to go. I think you've heard my illustration about the baton, about the relay race, that some parents give their child the baton of life so far ahead of others because they train them and they guide them and they direct them and they're wise and they know the scriptures and they're able to apply all of those things. But some of the rest of us didn't have that kind of parent. And maybe we found ourselves at 18 or 19 years old completely like that infant. We just haven't grown. We haven't learned. And so this is, I think, the idea where it says, he who spares his rod hates hates his son. Well, why does he hate his son? Because a child that grows up without discipline is a child who cannot move forward in work and in the Lord's vineyard or in the church. This needs to be taken care of. Chasten your son while there is hope, and do not set your heart on his destruction. Most of us remember when we were in high school, there was always one or two kids who ended up getting killed because they just didn't know how to have self-control, realizing the dangers and not being selfish about the way they were living their lives. And the parents, they bear some of the blame if that's what happened. Now, that's not always the case, but sometimes it is. Foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child. The rod of correction will drive it far from him. Now, again, some of us were harder to raise than others. I think my parents threw up their hands at about 6 years old and gave up, because I was that guy at 19 who found himself having to start the process really late. Because if you don't have parents, and I don't blame them, because I consider myself to have been quite the handful. But do not withhold correction from a child. For if you beat him with a rod, he will not die. You shall beat him with a rod and deliver his soul from Sheol. Now, we all understand this is not a very politically correct verse anymore. And that we've all heard stories about how a parent who disciplines their child in a store ends up being called in and ends up having to deal with that. But this is still absolutely true. And this one, I think, is the most applicable to what we're dealing with tonight. The rod and rebuke give wisdom. But a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. Now, why is that? Why can't kids just grow up straight and true? Why can't children just learn by themselves how to grow up and serve other people? Well, because they didn't start that way. And we might question or wonder, well, I wonder why God created us in such a way as to be so selfish when we're infants and gave us or created a situation where some of us can't let that go. And if the parents don't deal with it, if they don't recognize it and give them wisdom, remember Jesus grew in wisdom, but a child left to himself brings shame to his mother. Correct your son and he will give you rest. Yes, he will give delight to your soul. And so some of us had better parents than others. As you're reading these things, you're thinking about yourself as a parent. You're thinking about yourself as a child. You're wondering whether you couldn't have done a better job helping your children to be less selfish. And you're wondering whether your parents couldn't have done. Or maybe you know your parents could have done a better job. But the point is, none of that really matters except to take stock of where we are. And to realize that selfishness should have been, quote, beaten out of us before our memories. This is something I found very fascinating, is that if you do your job correctly, by the time your children are 5 years old, they're already moving in the right direction, and they can't even remember all the beatings you gave them. But a lot of parents don't understand that. They don't realize that. And then it's almost too late. I think that once children hit 5 or 6 years old, it's pretty much catch up. It's pretty difficult to bring them back into submission. So now we're adults. And some were more subject to their parents than others. And some grew in wisdom, some less. Some more, some less. How selfish was I? And that I means you and me. How selfish were we growing up? How much did we give to other people in grade school, in high school, in our young adulthood? How much time did we spend caring about other people's needs versus living a self-centered life where basically it's all about me? And I've heard an expression, the me generation. But I'm not sure we weren't all me generations, just as I say, some more and some less. So, but the lesson tonight is going to be dealing with this. How selfish am I now? Now, how we got here is important. I think it's really important, and that's why I introduced the lesson this way, because we need to take stock. And there's no point in blaming your parents. As we understand, a victim can't be helped because it's not their fault. And there's nothing they can do to correct it. We need to take responsibility. Yeah, we're probably half a victim, or maybe we're 75% victim. But the bottom line is, we could have done better whether we had help or not. And so this lesson is going to be a mirror. And it's going to be a mirror that no matter how far we are, we're going to see there's probably a pretty good chasm between where we are and where we ought to be. And that's just the nature of it. Because it's a difficult thing to do. So, would you call yourself humble? Would you call yourself proud? Does the world revolve around you, or does the world revolve around others? And this, again, is a struggle. It's a hard question to ask. We can see other people's faults pretty clearly. Sometimes it's really tough to see our own faults. And that's why I spend a lot of time in my preaching helping us to see. And I try not to make it a you versus I. I try to make it an us. Because, as I say, there's no human on the face of the earth who can't see further ahead to where they should be versus where they are right now. And when we look at the perfect law of liberty, when we look at the perfect standard, we often find ourselves far short of where we ought to be. And that's not a bad thing, because that gives us the opportunity to repent. It gives us the opportunity to make the changes. I mean, there's no point. We can't fix and we can't make up for what we've lost. You can't change, we can't change the past. We can't change what we have been. But we can look at it and we can say to ourselves, I'm going to do better. I'm going to make myself less selfish. These apostles were very selfish. I'm amazed sometimes at how they didn't get it. But here's a conversation between, first of all, between them among themselves when Jesus isn't around, then the embarrassment when he catches them, and then his attempt to do what their parents should have done, and that is to get them thinking properly. So he came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked them, "What was it you disputed among yourselves on the road?" But they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves who would be the greatest. Now, I think we've all done this in a joking way with different people. We joke about how I'm better than this or I'm better at that. In high school, these guys are in their 30s. And it is just not appropriate. And they knew it. I mean, they knew enough about what they were supposed to be like as to say to themselves, we better not tell Jesus what we were doing. Of course, and they probably figured that out eventually, he knew what they were doing. But in verse 35, he sat down, called the 12, and he said to them, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." Now, Jesus, as I put in the heading, he turns things upside down. This is not how we would normally look at it. We would normally look at it in the workplace or in politics or in a family. There's a hierarchy. And in the hierarchy, the people on the top, ever heard the expression, it's nice to be on the top of the food chain? Those people on the top, they get the best. And other people serve them. And so a worldly father sees himself as someone, his wife should serve him, his children should serve him, he has no obligation to them. And I see this when I go to Malawi and they haven't been trained, they haven't been taught. This is how they see life. They see life as a hierarchy. And that the father is in total control. Well, that's how these people looked at it. And the more you had, the more intelligent you were, the more money you had, the stronger you were, the more charismatic, in other words, some special ability. And if we're proud and arrogant, we say to ourselves, this makes me better than everyone else. And that very concept tells us that we have a serious problem. Because instead of looking at our gifts and abilities as something that should cause us to be the greatest, we should see those gifts and abilities as an opportunity, as Peter will say, to minister it among ourselves. And to give these gifts to others. Paul deals with this in Romans 12. We'll deal with this a little bit later. But he says that in a human body, there are various members, and all the members have a responsibility to use those gifts for the betterment of others, just like my body does. My head never says I'm the greatest. It just works with all the other parts of the body, functioning as a unit, happy to have hands, happy to have feet, glad to have ears and eyes, and never thinking which one's the best. I don't really think like that, and you don't think like that. I don't look at my hands and say, this is the best part of my body. But if the individual parts could speak, as they do in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, when Paul says we were all baptized into one body, and the hand should not say to the foot, I don't need you. And the eye shouldn't say to the ear, because I'm not a part of the body, or excuse me, because I'm not an eye, I'm not a part of the body. They kept silent because they knew better, just like we would know better. Let another praise you and not your own lips. And so as we consider this, we have to look within ourselves and see, are my gifts for me, making me better than the rest of the congregation and making me expect that everyone in the congregation should bow down to me because of these great abilities and make their lives according or accommodating to me? And Jesus says, absolutely not. If you want to be the lowest person in the congregation, you may have the greatest gifts, the greatest abilities. You might be the smartest, the best looking, the most wealthy, the most charismatic. You might have the best job. You might look at yourself and say to yourself, I'm so successful and I'm probably the best person in this congregation. That's what the apostles were doing. Very disruptive. The reason Jesus is hitting so hard on this is because he's dealing with it every day with those Pharisees. We're going to see in Matthew 23, they love to make broad their phylacteries. And they like to say, like that guy in Luke chapter 18, I thank you, God, that I'm not like everyone else. I'm not like this publican here. I'm much greater. Instead of seeing the publican as someone who had a need that he could serve, he saw the publican as somebody to step on. He saw the publican as someone to sneer at, somebody to look down upon. So Jesus calls them all together, and he makes this simple, profound statement, and that is, regardless of your gifts and abilities, if you want to be first in the eyes of God, if you want to be great in the eyes of God, then be last of all and servant of all. Now, in Malawi, I will illustrate this with what we do when the food comes out and everyone else is there. Do you quickly grab the best, or do you hold back and let other people take the best because they ought to have it, and then when they're all done, then you take what's left? Now, one is an attitude of service. The other is an attitude of, I'm greater, and I want the best piece. And so the father tells the wife, you make sure I always get the best. But then there's another father who says, I want everyone else to be able to enjoy this, and so I'm going to take this piece of meat over here, which I can see just by looking at it, is not going to be the best piece. And I know that's a pretty foolish way to illustrate it, but it makes the point. And you can see, you go to work and there's a plate of donuts and you say, man, that one in the middle, that's the best one. I'm going to take that. Or do you say to yourself, that's the best one and I'm going to leave that for somebody else and I'm going to take this one. And it's just, again, it's an indicator. It's an indicator. When we're driving on the freeway, everybody should get out of my way because I'm the best person on the road. And everybody should see that and they should just get out of my way and just bow down to me as I drive by. And if they don't, then we get a little irritated. And that irritation is a very serious indicator that you're pretty selfish. My wife lets me know that every time I grumble and grouse about the next driver in front of me who obviously shouldn't be driving because he's a, you know, and then you can fill in the blank. And that's not what Jesus is referring to here. You know, the fascinating thing, it doesn't matter. You know, on the last night Jesus was here, those apostles said some pretty outlandish things. You never see him lashing out. You never see him angry. You never see him frustrated with that. Now, you see frustration when these people are hard-hearted and they won't make the moves, but you don't see that. So if anyone desires to be first, take a look at whether you take the best. You want the chief seats in the synagogue, and you want the best food, and you want to be called rabbi, or you want to be treated that way. Jesus doesn't need apostles like that. Jesus doesn't need elders like that. As a matter of fact, every position of leadership, as far as God is concerned, is a position of service, just like God. God is the greatest. And as far as I'm concerned, after looking at the physical creation, after looking at him sending his son to die for us, after looking with him at him tolerating all of the rebellion and all, as Enoch put it, all the wicked things that the ungodly have said against him and the wicked deeds or ungodly deeds that they have ungodly wrought. But he did that for us. This is the heart of the pride of life. That's what these people were struggling with, was the pride of life. I'm better. God didn't give us these wonderful gifts in order for us to become proud. He gave us these wonderful gifts in order for us to become servants. And so this is the mirror I've put up in front of all of us, and you can make the application how much work you need to do. I hope that none of us are unscathed, because if you are unscathed, then you're not listening. There's no one here who is perfectly unselfish, who perfectly responds to what everybody says and understands the need to become all things to all men and to sacrifice. And as Paul said to the Corinthians, why not rather take wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? If you really want harmony in the church, and if you're not a selfish person, you're going to let people walk on you and turn the other cheek. If you can't turn the other cheek, then you're not a servant. If you can't go the second mile, if you can't rather be defrauded, if you can't swallow your pride in order to lift other people up to where they need to be, then the pride of life has got us. Selfish desires are competing with the need to love, sacrifice, and help others. I've got the problem. Maybe I'm the only one here who has this problem. The rest of you are saying, man, do we have a bad preacher? Because listen to him talking about how selfish he is. Or maybe all of us are saying to ourselves, we're in the same boat as he is. We all have difficulties with this. selfish desires competing with the need. And so what does Jesus say? If anyone desires to be first, have you ever put yourself last? How would you? How would you put yourself last? Well, we see how Dorcas did it. And we see how Barnabas did it. Barnabas was a good man. The only good man really described in the scriptures. He was a good man. I think the context there is he went out to get Paul, or Saul of Tarsus, to bring him into the church. But in chapter 4, the preview of Ananias and Sapphira and their selfish act, they did the same thing that Barnabas did. They just made a few tweaks, a few very selfish tweaks. Barnabas and Dorcas are classic examples. Paul, I would gladly spend and be spent for your souls. I become all things. Even though I'm free from all men, I become all things to all men. Even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. Now, if that was his philosophy and his attitude, where do we fit in? Now, we certainly, in our youth, didn't look at life like this. And some of us in our 20s and 30s and 40s haven't really looked at it like this. But Jesus did. And the context of this passage, we'll see in just a moment. Who is greater, he who sits at the table or he who serves? Is it not he who sits at the table? Yet I am among you as the one who serves. Now that's the paradox, isn't it? That's the paradox you would think. And that's why Peter said, you'll never wash my feet. Because as far as Peter was concerned, Jesus was the greatest person on earth, and he was. And that, in Peter's mind, meant all the rest of us should bow down and serve him and not allow him to serve us. And Jesus rebuked him soundly. Matter of fact, he said, if I don't wash your feet, you have no part with me. You are not even a disciple. You don't understand. So the petition of James and John in Mark chapter 10. Grant that we may sit on your right and left hand when you come into your kingdom. And when Jesus said, you know not what you ask, they're asking to be put ahead of Moses and Elijah. They're asking to be put ahead of Job and Abraham. Because when Jesus comes into his kingdom, all of those people, remember Hebrews chapter 12, the spirits of just men made perfect. All of those godly men and women who lived in the Old Testament, the ones who were sawn in half, the ones that went about in sheepskins and goatskins. And Peter and John, or James and John, are here asking him to be number one and number two in the kingdom. Now, the response of the other ten, again, the request is selfish. But when the ten heard it, they began to be indignant at James and John. And I've often thought that may be because they didn't think of it first. Because they got in ahead of them. Because they wanted something that everyone else, instead of pitying them and thinking to themselves, wow, can't believe James and John would do that. I can't believe that they would not understand the nature of unselfish service. But no, they become indignant. Because even though Jesus has already told them once that the greater will serve the lesser, they haven't gotten it yet. And so the truth is, as again he says, whoever would be great among you must be your servant. And whoever would be first among you must be the slave of all. Which means Dorcas was the greatest in the kingdom, in that congregation, unless somebody else was ahead of her in service. But if we are not doing any service, think about it. Jesus said even a cup of cold water, but when's the last time we even did that? And so this is a serious question. We've talked about this in the past because of Social Security and health insurance and life insurance and car insurance. We don't find ourselves in situations very often like James talks about where somebody is hungry and destitute and in lack of food. And so that act of service has kind of gone away because we just don't have that in our culture. And preaching to the lost today is a very difficult task in which we don't really get the opportunity to serve because we get a few words out and we get cut. So, what do we need to be doing to be a servant? Well, that's the question, isn't it? We'll deal with this as the lesson unfolds. But I just want us to see that even these 12 apostles were really struggling. Their parents, and you say, well, they didn't do a very good job. Well, I don't know if they did or not. Because even the best parents who trained up their children perfectly, the children are still going to find there's still some residue of selfishness there because you can't stamp it out by outside influences. It has to be stamped out on the inside. So now we're on Jesus' final night. They're eating the Passover meal. They're in the midst of either just before or just after the Lord's Supper. Matter of fact, it's right in the middle of it. And they still haven't grown out. There was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. So after 3 years of hard work, Jesus has not accomplished what he hoped to accomplish. And that's where the foot washing will come in, which we'll probably talk about next week. But now there was also a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. And once again, brethren, what would they use as their criteria? Who's the greatest member of the church here? And what's the criteria for what makes him the greatest? Why would... Now, the Pharisee in Luke chapter 18, he figured he was the greatest because he understood sin and had a little more self-control than that that publican over there. But compared to Christ or compared to God, where was he? All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And God said to those in the Old Testament, to this man I will look, to him who has a broken and contrite spirit and who trembles at my word. In other words, there's nothing really for us to look at that would indicate I'm the greatest. And so there was a dispute among them as to which of them should be considered the greatest. They still wanted to be served. They didn't want to learn. So here's Jesus' answer. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. And those who exercise authority over them are called benefactors. But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. And he who governs, as he who serves. So every gift is for service. Let's look at that just for a second here. Let's go over to Romans chapter 12. Romans 12 and Peter, 1 Peter 4 both deal with this concept. In verse 3 of Romans chapter 12, "For this I say through the grace given to me to everyone who is among you, don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith." So Abraham is no greater than Joseph, or no greater than Job, or no greater than that individual who went about in sheepskins and goatskins, afflicted, ill-treated, and nothing was ever written about them, or those that were cut in half. Because as Paul points out here, each one of us has been given a gift. Don't think of yourself more highly than you ought to think, but think soberly as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. Now, some people say, well, that's how much faith God put in our hearts. Well, that can't be true because he just said in Romans chapter 10, faith comes by hearing. Well, God doesn't put it in our hearts. Well, then what does this mean? It means the way we measure out our faith. If you have the ability, as he goes on to say in verse 6, having gifts differing according to the grace that is given to us, let us use them. If prophecy, let us prophesy in proportion to our faith. If ministry, let us use it in our ministry. You know, over the years, I have watched preachers who go overseas and come home and they just talk about like they're really something special. And I don't know if you've noticed it. I try not to talk about it. I don't talk about it because I consider it a gift. I don't consider it something that makes me special. I just consider it, God brought this into my life, and it doesn't make me any better than anyone else. It just gives me an opportunity to measure out my faith in a little different way. But some people would say, boy, Alan is a great Christian because he goes to Africa every year. Well, I don't see it that way, and I don't think that's the way it's supposed to be seen. Paul didn't think he was a great Christian, but his service to the Lord makes mine look like nothing. And yet, what does Paul say? Though I am nothing. After he talks about all, you remember in chapter 2 Corinthians, I think it's 11 or 12, somewhere in there, he says, you're forcing me to boast. And he says, I'm talking beside myself. I'm talking about one who's crazy. I don't like talking like this. Because Paul understood what he was saying here. Having then gifts differing according to grace. So it's not I'm better than everyone else because I can do this. It's I have more responsibility than everyone else because I can do this. Again, in 1 Peter chapter 4, he says that if we have a gift, let us minister it or use it among ourselves. Let's use it. The problem with the rich man who ended up in torments was that he didn't use his wealth, which was a gift, to serve Lazarus. He didn't see Lazarus as someone to care about. And Jesus deals with that in several of the parables. You remember in, Luke, I think chapter 10, 11, somewhere in there, where Jesus says, make use of unrighteous mammon so that when it fails, they will receive you into everlasting tabernacles. In other words, money is a gift. And money is a way to serve others. It's not a way. Now, most wealthy people do think they're a little better than everyone else. Most of us don't have that problem because we're not wealthy. But if we had several million dollars, and of course that's not even very much anymore. Everybody can be a millionaire now because that's kind of the way it's gone. So let's talk about a billionaire. Anyway, that's beside the point. In verse 26, not so among you. At Gentiles, you look in the political realm, the more power they have, the more they take care of themselves. And seemingly, the lower we are in their esteem. Kind of like the Pharisees who said, those people who don't know the law are accursed. And then when they come back and say, never man so spake, they look at them and say, have any of the rulers believed in him? As if that's some big deal, because none of the rulers would believe. We're greater than everyone else, and if we don't believe, then how could you even think that this man would be worthy of listening to? But not so among you. On the contrary, he who is greatest among you, let him be as the younger. Now, when we stand before God on the judgment day, this is going to be the criteria to determine who was greatest, how much we served, and how humble we were in putting other people before ourselves. You know, I wasn't going to cover this tonight, so pretend you didn't see that. I don't want to talk about that this evening. I just wanted to lay a groundwork and give us an opportunity to think about ourselves, what we really are. Look in the mirror. Go home tonight and think about this lesson. Don't let this slip away. This is a very important thing. The American people are viewed as being very selfish, and I don't think that's slander. I think that many of the American people are very selfish. We are given the freedom to be selfish. We can do whatever we want to do with our time, with our money, with our opportunities. And America is such a place of opportunity that we can just fire off to the top if we have any abilities at all. And it tends to make us arrogant and complacent and self-satisfied, and oftentimes, because everybody else is so much worse, we don't even really see ourselves clearly. So the criteria is Jesus saying, if you want to be great, it's not because you're a little less proud than all the rest of Americans, it's because your time is given to the care and concern of other people, and that you're willing to be spent, and be spent. And that you see your time as something to be shared. And your gifts as something to be shared. And so as we conclude the lesson, I think I had a really good slide, but I'm not even going to try to get to it. Let's just go ahead and... Whoop, wrong button. There we go. So I guess you can let me know, if you want to, whether this sermon is applicable to you or not. Whether you're saying to yourself, I don't know why Ellen's preaching this. I'm not selfish at all. I hope nobody's saying that. If you come to me and say that, just be ready. Because I may have a few choice words to say about that as far as making applications. All right, let's go ahead and turn over to page 320. Will Jesus find us watching? Given us a lot of food for thought this evening, and I think most of us are feeling maybe a little bit uncomfortable, maybe feeling like maybe we didn't, or maybe we have squandered a little bit of our times and abilities on ourselves. And as I said at the beginning of the lesson, there's nothing we can do about that. Can't go back and change the past. We can only change the future and the present. And so as we sing this song, if there's anyone in the audience who recognizes that they need to make a personal commitment to themselves, publicly confess some particular activity that has made them selfish and has kept them from serving others, and if we can help you in any way, we would hope that you would make that known to us while we together stand and sing.